You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. This is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm Chuck Coughlin. Come along with me today. Our subject is the Crusades. Well, we've got an hour program. We can only do a little bit, very high altitude, not much detail. This is a very complex issue. One historian wrote a 10-volume series about the Crusades. But the issue of the Crusades is very much in the news. So it's worth talking about some aspects of it. Aspects that are very important to Catholics, because a lot of negative things have been said about the Catholic Church and the Crusades for the last 200-300 years. So let's set the record straight a little bit. In the last half century, many of us have become accustomed to a very negative description of the Crusades. The Crusades are described as barbaric, wasteful, shameful, and even sinful. Rarely are they called glorious. This is because the modern world embraces a false narrative about the Crusades. This false story, however, much discredited by authentic modern scholarship, remains entrenched in the minds of the masses. Responsible historians have long known that the image of the Crusader as an adventurer seeking his fortune is exactly backward. The vast majority of Crusaders were not colonists. They returned home as soon as they had fulfilled their penitential vow. And the trip usually impoverished them. These were expensive trips. One is hard-pressed to name a single returning Crusader who broke even, let alone made a profit on the journey. And even those that returned home were the lucky ones. Recent studies show that around one-third of the knights and nobility died on the Crusade. The death rates for the lower classes were even higher. We don't really have those figures. But they were phenomenal. On one of the campaigns that the earlier pilgrimages called the Crusades had to cross, later travelers or pilgrims, for decades afterwards, were liable to see on the distant horizons a white mountain, a mountain as white as snow. If he was to approach it closely, he would see it was a mountain of human bones. Because this is where 50,000 unarmed pilgrims, old men, young children, were killed in one day, and they offered no defense. These Catholics on their way to the Holy Land, on a pilgrimage, offered no resistance, and they had few weapons. They were met by a Muslim army that attacked them. The Muslim warriors were expert archers. They fired volley after volley of arrows. And when they ran out of arrows, they went and retrieved the arrows from the dead and dying and fired them again. Did these pilgrims take no action at all? Oh, yes, they took action. When the attack began and throughout it, they fell to their knees and prayed to God to take their souls to heaven. They died there, one stacked upon the other, as martyrs. Martyrs who had completed their penance. Martyrs who were on their way to heaven. I picked this out of the many, many stories about the Crusade because it illustrates a point. Penance and indulgence are important factors in the Crusades. One of the chief misunderstandings among non-Catholics today results from this one factor. It's often that non-Catholics of today have lost any idea about what an indulgence is and what a penance is. That after confession, you're given a penance, and we must atone for our sins on earth through works, as a Protestant would say, through works. We Catholics must work out our salvation with fear and trembling. We Catholics do not receive an unerasable salvation. We have to keep it by how we behave. So one could never understand the Crusades without understanding their penitential character. It was to receive the indulgence that led thousands of persons to take on the burden that would certainly cost them dearly. The secular nobility of medieval Europe was a warrior aristocracy. They made their living by the sword. We know from their wills and charters that they were deeply aware of their own sinfulness and anxious over the state of their souls. A crusade provided a way for them to serve God and to do penance for their sins. It allowed them to use their weapons as a means of their salvation rather than of their damnation. It was a difficult penance. As Pope Urban and later Crusader preachers reminded them, Christ himself had said, "If any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." As one man, inspiring Crusaders, wrote, "Those who take the cross deny, that is to say, renounce themselves by exposing themselves to mortal danger, leaving behind their loved ones, using up their goods, carrying their cross, so that afterward they may be carried to heaven by the cross." It was a custom of the Crusaders to sew a cross to their garments to signify the penitential burden and the hope. Take away the penance, and you cannot understand the Crusades. Of late, the Crusades have been defended by many, but many of these people, not being Catholic, don't understand the penitential aspect of it. In the 17th and 18th centuries, Protestants and then Enlightenment thinkers rejected the idea of temporal penalties due to sin, along with indulgences, purgatory, and the papacy. As time went on, the meaning of these things faded, and also faded a true understanding of history. So given this gap in knowledge and understanding and empathy, how did non-Catholics then explain the Crusades? How could they explain it? Why else would thousands of men and women and children and old men march thousands of miles deep into enemy territory if not for something precious? Well, the first explanation was that they were fooled by the Antichrist, the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church had convinced these simple-minded people that their salvation lay in fighting its battles. Later, with the advent of liberalism, critics assumed that the Catholic Crusaders must have had economic motives. They were seeking wealth and simply used religion as a cover for their worldly desires. In the 19th century, the memory of the Crusades became hopelessly entangled with contemporary European imperialism. In our own time, various leaders, presidents, prime ministers, have tried to explain to their countries that we are at fault in many ways for inciting the jihad against us, which is going on so viciously now. This has been done by our current president, and it's worth quoting President Clinton in a speech he made in year 2001 to Georgetown University students, which used to be a Catholic university and claims to be still. Trying to make sense of the senseless, President Clinton offered his own explanation. He said, "Those of us who come from various European lineages are not blameless. Indeed, in the First Crusade, when the Christian soldiers took Jerusalem, they first burned a synagogue with 300 Jews in it and proceeded to kill every woman and child who was Muslim on the Temple Mount." The contemporaneous descriptions of the event describe soldiers walking on the Temple Mount, a holy place to Christians, with blood running up to their knees. I can tell you that the story is still being told today in the Middle East, and we're still paying for it. Thus spoke President Clinton in 2001. The incident he described did take place, but is greatly, greatly exaggerated in his version, which he seems to have adopted from popular misconceptions, from mishistory. Osama bin Laden did issue his fatwa authorizing the September 11th attack against, quote, Crusaders and Jews. However, most people in the West do not believe that they have been prosecuting a continuous crusade against Islam since the Middle Ages. But most of us do believe that the Crusades ignited the problem, started the problem. This is mistaken. The rivers of blood up to the knees is just a legend. It's not true. That there were atrocities committed by some Crusaders, no one would deny. Unfortunately, there are atrocities in every war. Everyone commits some atrocities, and all Catholics and Christians deplore them. But it's important to set the record straight to get your history straight. A recent Ridley Scott movie about the Crusades called Kingdom of Heavens graphically proclaimed that the Crusades were unprovoked campaigns of intolerance preached by deranged churchmen and fought by religious zealots against a sophisticated and peaceful Muslim world. But Hollywood and the media have been involved in a long campaign to teach us to fall out of love with ourselves and our country and our God. According to the Hollywood version, the blind violence of the Crusades gave birth to jihad as the Muslims fought to defend themselves and their world. And for what? The city of Jerusalem, which was both nothing and everything, a place filled with religion that, quote, drives men mad. However, real historians have looked at this issue and seen that it was not till the 19th century that the Muslim world even had much memory at all of the Crusades. Until the last 150 years, the Muslim world regarded the Crusades as a very minor series of incidents in their history. It was the Western world that brought their attention to it. Actually, this legend, this black legend, negative legend about the Crusades, this black legend, is an invention of the Western world, and I'm sorry to say it, of those who oppose the Catholic Church and are looking for a way to attack it. And most sadly, this has included our Protestant brothers and sisters. The Muslim memory of the Crusades is actually a very recent vintage. Carol Hildebrand first uncovered this fact in her groundbreaking book, The Crusade, Islamic Perspectives. The truth is that medieval Muslims came to realize that the Crusades were religious, but had little interest in them. When in 1291 the Muslim armies removed the last vestiges of the Crusader kingdom from Palestine, the Crusades largely dropped out of Muslim memory. In Europe, however, the Crusades were a well-remembered formative episode. Europeans who had confused the Crusades with imperialisms brought the story to the Middle East during the 19th century and reintroduced it to the Muslims, stripping the Crusades of their original purpose. They portrayed them as Europe's first colonial venture, the first attempt of the West to bring civilization to the backward Muslim East. We'll take a break now. See you the other side of it.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
We're back after the break on breadboxmedia.com. This is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm Chuck Coughlin. This is Chuck Coughlin. I'm so glad you rejoined us. Thanks. We were just considering how this negative legend about the Crusades was an invention of the West a little more than 150 years ago. And that legend made its way to the Middle East and has affected the modern perception of the colonizing imperialistic crusaders. Actually, the big issue about the Crusades was not an issue in the Muslim world until this slanderous image of these pilgrimages and campaigns of the Catholic Church were created for modern purposes by anti-Catholics. When we examine why Islam hates the West, we might examine the very strange fact that the myths about the Crusade began in the 16th century, in the 1500s, as Protestant revolutionaries attacked what they viewed as papal campaigns designed to increase the wealth of the Catholic Church. The creation of myths about the Crusades continued throughout the time of the Enlightenment, right up to the present day. Arab nations used the Crusades as propaganda to produce recruits for the jihad against the West. Western intellectuals use it to attack the church. Both groups profit by fostering the falsehood that the Crusades are the source of the modern-day tension between Islam and the West. The historical reality is far removed from this. The Crusades were largely ignored as an important part of Islamic history soon after the fall of Acre in 1291 and were then forgotten in the Islamic world. A considerable revival of interest in the Crusades occurred only in the 19th century, only receiving prominent attention in the 20th. It's easy to understand why for hundreds of years the Muslims did not remember the Crusades, since they represented a small and insignificant portion of Islamic history. The holy city of Jerusalem had only been won back by Catholics for a short period, 88 years, 1099 till 1187, and the Crusader states survived for less than two centuries. The goals of the Crusades were not successful, and therefore Islamic historians neglected the Crusades. The modern Islamic attitude toward the Crusades began in the 20th century as a reconstructed memory of these events. Ironically, it was the European colonial powers, especially the 19th century French version of the Crusades as a proto-colonizing expedition, that laid the foundation for the modern Muslim interpretation of the movement. Through Western colonization, Enlightenment intellectuals from the very nations that once took the cross birthed the modern Arab remembering of the Crusades. It's disconcerting to recognize that it is a component of our own countries, our own Western countries, that is, the Western postmodern intellectuals and the media elites, and the anti-Catholics. They gave birth to the jihad in its modern form. It wasn't the Crusades that gave birth to the jihad. It was the anti-Catholic distortion of the legend of the Crusades, invented by members of our own communities, that has played a major role in bringing this jihad upon all of us. It is truly ironic that these persons expressing their anti-Catholicism through the arts, the media, the politics, and academia, that has reaped a whirlwind. They have sown a whirlwind that has come back upon their houses as well as ours. Let me offer a few observations about the beginnings of this anti-Catholic black legend. Some of the beginnings are in the 19th century. Let me cite one. A novel by Sir Walter Scott, The Talisman, had a profound effect on the European and therefore Middle Eastern opinion of the Crusades. Crusaders such as Richard the Lionhearted were portrayed as boorish, brutal, and childish, while Muslims, particularly Saladin, were tolerant and enlightened gentlemen of the 19th century. With the collapse of the Ottoman power and the rise of Arab nationalism at the end of the 19th century, Muslims bound together these two strands of Crusade narratives. Muslims took this Crusade narrative and created a new memory in which the Crusades were only the first part of Europe's assault on Islam, an assault that continued through the modern imperialism of European powers. Europeans reintroduced Saladin, who had been nearly forgotten in the Middle East, and then Arab nationalists cleansed him of his Kurdish ethnicity to create a new anti-Western hero. He was now Saladin the Magnificent. We saw the result during the run-up to the Iraq War, when Saddam Hussein portrayed himself as a new Saladin the Magnificent who would expel the new Crusaders. And we think that this history has no effect? It does. Arab nationalists made good use of the new story of the Crusades during their struggles for independence. Their enemies, the Islamists, then took over the same tool. Osama bin Laden is only the most recent Islamist to adopt this useful myth to characterize the action of the West as a continuous crusade against Islam, as having motivations of imperialism. One of the most profound misconceptions about the Crusades is that they represented a perversion of religion whose founder preached meekness, love of enemies, and non-resistance, passive non-resistance. The historian Riley Smith reminds his readers that on the matter of violence, Christ was not as clear as pacifists like to think. He praised the faith of the Roman centurion, but did not condemn his profession. At the Last Supper, he told his disciples, "Let him who has no sword sell his cloak and buy one, for I tell you that this scripture must be fulfilled in me." And he was reckoned with transgressors. St. Paul said of secular authorities, "He does not bear the sword in vain. He is the servant of God to execute his wrath upon the wrongdoer." Several centuries later, St. Augustine articulated a Christian approach to just war, one in which legitimate authorities could use violence to halt or avert a greater evil. It must be a defensive war in reaction to the act of an aggression. The Crusades were certainly that, because Islam had proselyted with a sword. The great historian Wilder Rance made the comment that Islam has bloody borders. Islam, by conquering and forcing conversions by the sword, had taken over the entire Middle East, including the Holy Land, and had set its sight on Europe. As a matter of fact, it had taken over North Africa, was approaching from the east and the west, had taken over the Iberian Peninsula. Its announced intention was to create a global caliphate, caliph who ruled the entire world by Sharia law. It would have meant the extinction of Christianity. That is what the Crusaders fought their defensive war, their just war, to prevent. Since Catholicism had a mature theology that articulated in detail the description of what a just war was, it followed this. It had to be one in which legitimate authorities could use violence to halt or avert a greater evil. It must be a defensive war in reaction to an act of aggression. For Catholics, therefore, violence was ethically neutral, since it could be employed either for evil or against evil. The concept that violence is intrinsically evil belongs solely to the modern world. It is not a Christian concept. The historian Riley Smith states that all the Crusades met the criteria of just wars. They came about in reaction to attacks against Catholics or their church. The first crusade in 1095 was in response to the recent Turkish conquest of Asia Minor, which was a Catholic area, much as was the earlier Arab conquest of the Catholic-held Holy Land. The second crusade was called in response to the Muslim conquest of Edessa. The third was called in response to the Muslim conquest of Jerusalem. In each case, the faithful went to war to defend Christians, to punish the attackers, and to right terrible wrongs. Crusading at that time was seen as an act of love, specifically the love of God and the love of neighbor. Pushing back Muslim aggression, restoring Eastern Christianity, the Crusaders, at great peril to themselves, were imitating the Good Samaritan. Or as Pope Innocent II told the Knights Templar, "You carry out in deeds the words of the gospel. Greater love has no man than this. The man laid down his life for his friends." But the Crusades were more than just wars. They were holy wars. And that made all the difference. That made them very different from what had come before. They were made holy not by their target, but by the Crusader's sacrifice. The Crusade was a pilgrimage, and thereby an act of penance. When Pope Urban II called the First Crusade, he created a model that would be followed for centuries. Crusaders undertook that burden with right intention, and after confessing their sins, they would receive a plenary indulgence if they went on a crusade. The indulgence was a recognition that they undertook these sacrifices for Christ, who was crucified again in the tribulations of his people. And their sacrifices were extraordinary. Without financial assistance, only the wealthy could afford to embark on a crusade. Many noble families impoverished themselves by crusadings. It must be noted that the Christian understanding of holy war differs greatly from the Muslim teaching on jihad. Jihad is incumbent upon all Muslims. Christian holy war is not incumbent on every believer. Indeed, participation in the Crusades was always voluntary, and violence is seen as a necessary evil that can only be entered into for serious and just reasons. Christian teaching even places restrictions on the nature of warfare and on the intentions of those who participate. Jihad harbors no such limitation. The main purpose of jihad is offensive. Christian holy war is defensive. This is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm Chuck Coughlin. We'll break now for a few moments.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Well, let's get back to the Crusaders. They undertook their long pilgrimage for the best of reasons. Some people think the Crusades were a mistake and should never have occurred. Others think that while they may have been justified at the time, Christianity has undergone sufficient reforms, in quotes, to prevent such things from happening again. But Islam has not been tamed by having its own Protestant Reformation. Well, I could reject both notions. Do you think the Crusades were an example of unjustifiable religious violence? The historical facts are that a long train of Muslim abuses preceded the launching of the First Crusade in 1096. Since its very inception, Islam had waged an unrelenting war against Christianity. It conquered and subjugated centuries of Christian society, Catholic societies in the Middle East and North Africa. After sweeping through France, the Muslim advance was finally checked by Charles Martel at the Battle of Tours, 732 AD. Following this Muslim aggression against Christians, continued in southern Italy with the conquest of Sicily in 827. Resistance to these repeated acts of aggression was not characterized as a crusade, but simply necessary self-defense. Over the next centuries, the Turks, who converted to Islam, waged a war against the Eastern Christian Byzantine Empire. At a battle, the Turks wiped out the Byzantine army, leaving Emperor Alexius Comnenus helpless before the relentless and determined foe. Not long after this, he sent envoys to Pope Urban II, pleading for military aid. The Council of Clermont was called by the Pope, in which he addressed the clergy and knights and commoners who had assembled. He spoke especially to the knights. His words were both reproving and encouraging. He started by criticizing the Europeans themselves, the Catholics themselves, for fighting among themselves in the various small kingdoms over territory and property. These were not kind words. They needed the criticism. But one can readily see that the Pope saw a way that they might end these conflicts by uniting against one common enemy. He hoped they might come together at last. Here's a small piece of what he said. "You, the oppressors of children, plunderers of widows, you, guilty of homicide, of sacrilege, robbers of another's rights, you who await the pay of fees for the shedding of Christian bloods, as vultures smell fetid corpses. So do you sense battles from afar and rush to them eagerly? Verily, this is the worst way, for it is utterly removed from God. If, forsooth, you wish to be mindful of your souls, either lay down the girdle of such knighthood, or advance boldly as knights of Christ, and rush as quickly as you can to the defense of the Eastern Church, for she it is from whom the joys of your whole salvation have come forth, who poured into your mouth the milk of divine wisdom, who set before you the holy teachings of the Gospels." So said Urban II. What was at stake was the preservation of Christianity and of Christian civilization, which had, if imperfectly, sought to embody its teachings in the world. Something terrible then happened in the year 1009. The Caliph Al-Hakim ordered the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in an act the Catholic Encyclopedia rightly calls a fit of madness, ordered it completely destroyed right to the ground and pounded into gravel. Caliph Hakim was not the only Muslim who had disregard for the Temple of the Holy Sepulchre. Muslims in general at the time referred to it as the Mount of Dung. This was followed by an even broader campaign against Christianity through the Levant, culminating in the destruction of thousands of Christian churches. Given the scale of the unprovoked and ceaseless attacks, as well as the persecutions of Christians within the Holy Land itself, Crusades were more than justified. Actually, they were a belated response to centuries of violent Islamic expansion, not a random and spontaneous act of aggression. And what about the issue of violence? There is a substantive difference between Islamic violence and Christian violence. Violence against and the persecution of Jews was never encouraged in Christianity or even tolerated by the papacy. Christianity did not need 1,000 years to clean up its act with regard to the Jews in response to the atrocities carried out by soldiers and crusading armies. Pope Calixtus II issued the bull Sicut Judaeus in 1120, which declares, among other things, that, quote, "The Jews ought to suffer no prejudice. We, out of the meekness of Christian piety, and keeping in the footprints of our predecessors of happy memory, the Roman pontiffs Calixtus Eugene, Alexander Clement, admit their petition, and we grant them the buckler of our protection." In other words, when Christians carried out acts of violence against Jews, they were doing so in disobedience to their religion and their spiritual leaders. This was also the case during the unfortunate sack of Constantinople during the Fourth Crusade, and there were mass excommunications as a result. A great portion of these errant crusaders were excommunicated before they ever arrived at Constantinople. Much in contrast, in the Islamic Hadith, we read, "The final hour will not start until after the Muslims fight the Jews and the Muslims kill them. The Jew will hide behind a stone or tree, and that tree will say, 'O Muslim, O servant of Allah, this is a Jew behind me, come and kill him.'" Could the contrast be more clear? Even the supposedly backward thoughts of medieval popes are progressive and enlightened compared to what a significant number of Muslims believe today. As for the inexcusable bloodletting in Jerusalem, while we deplore such individual instances, it was rather common at the time for savagery to follow a long and protracted siege of a city. We shouldn't react to it as if it were some great deviation from the standards of the time, which in themselves greatly deviate from our own. What about the very idea of the Crusades in the light of modern sensibilities? It's hard for us to empathize with it. This is a different time. Consider the great sacrifices made by the kings, knights, clergy, and peasants at the time to undergo this pilgrimage, thousands of miles away in the service of Christ and His church. Great risks were undertaken and losses suffered for no assurances of material compensation or reward. The crusader had to leave all behind and take up the cross. That is the noblest thing a human being can do, whether they bear arms in defense of their Christian brothers or live a life of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Or, as in the case of the Knights Templar, they do both. In today's circumstances, many have replaced the full, robust faith of the Christianity of medieval times with a shallow sort of secular humanism. Behind every Westerner's desire to, quote, free Tibet or to end genocide in Darfur is the same basic spirit, however, that motivated the original Crusades. It is a desire to bring justice and comfort to those suffering under the yoke of tyrants. Let us remember that the goals of the Crusades did not include the conversion of Muslims to Christianity, and that the few conversion attempts were made were largely unsuccessful. Not only that, but Arab travelers living at the time noted that the Muslims lived better under their Frankish rulers, their Christian rulers, than they did other Muslims. Let's remember that the Crusades failed, that the Islamo-Turks did overrun southeastern Europe and would have taken over all of the rest as well had they not been stopped twice at the gates of Vienna. That was 1529 and 1683. It may also be worth remembering that it was not until the so-called Age of Enlightenment that Europeans actually did conquer and colonize the Middle East and North Africa. Evidently, all of the supposed wisdom gained from the rejection of so-called medieval religions and the embrace of secularism, skepticism, humanism, and the rest didn't preclude unprovoked wars and imperial conquest out of Europe against the rest of the world. Of course, I'm sure the counter will be that we just hadn't gotten far enough away from religion yet. It's also worth remembering that in the first decade of the 18th century, President Thomas Jefferson launched a little crusade of his own against the Islamic Barbary pirates in North Africa, who again justifying their criminality and aggression through the Quran, had been capturing and pillaging the vessels of infidels for centuries. Thomas Jefferson didn't have to fight the Muslims, and many American statesmen would have rather paid them the ransom that they demanded rather than fight. But Jefferson was determined to end the extortion, and so he did. In 1805, American forces, along with local mercenaries, captured the city of Tripoli and brought the raids to an end. Some historians have viewed the Crusades not as a religious war, but as a conflict over territory, power, and resources. But that doesn't make sense. The Crusades were not into territorial expansions, although some limited events of that nature did take place. Some other understanding of this movement is in order.
If the men who participated in the Crusades were motivated largely by real appreciation for the holy sites of Catholic faith and the safety of the indigenous Catholics and pilgrims, then in it was indeed a dis. Then for that reason, it was indeed a defense of religious war. The proposition that must be rejected is that fighting in the name of faith is inherently problematic or flat out wrong, despite how frowned upon faith commitments are today in secular democracies. One needs to make it clear in one's mind. The medieval world was a good deal different from our modern system. There were no nation states, but only kingdoms and lords held in a delicate balance of peace that often broke into war among the worldly princes. The unifying feature of the whole of Europe was not its geopolitical authorities, but its Catholic faith. Let me say that again. The unifying feature of the whole of Europe was not its nation states, its geopolitical authorities, or something like the European Union. No, that was not the unifying factor. It was its Catholic faith, sometimes called Christendom. The force of which has sustained Europe still today in its cultural unity, regardless of how very scrupulously the EU Constitution attempts to skirt around it, and they have ignored the origins of Europe and the European culture. They've ignored that it has its foundation in Catholicism. So let us take a break now. This is BreadboxMedia.com. And the program is setting the record straight.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm Chuck Coughlin.
This is Chuck Coughlin welcoming you back after the break. This is Setting the Record Straight on BreadboxMedia.com. The webcasting miracle, the global reach of Catholic historical apologetics. And we're talking about the Crusades. The black legend is imposed by British historians who were opposed to Spain and therefore issued a lot of negative propaganda about the Catholic Church, about the Crusades, about the Inquisition. All a far better and more humane series of events than we've been taught. And this is, in a small way, doing a small correction. A large one needs to be done.
The modern Catholic may wonder why the Church recognized and supported the creation of religious orders who observed the evangelical councils of poverty, chastity, and obedience, with the added vows of military service for Christ and the Church, but also fought in combat. The same question was also raised by some Catholics during the 12th century, but the Church rightly emphasized the difference between killing an innocent person and an enemy soldier. Saint Bernard used the term malicide, the killing of evil. It was the extermination of injustice rather than of the unjust, and therefore desirable. Crusading was originally a temporary action, undertaken for a specified goal. With the establishment of the military religious orders in the 12th century, that temporary act of devotion became warfare as a devotional way of life. The development of these religious orders, whose members took a vow to live the evangelical counsels of poverty, chastity, and obedience, with the added vow of military service for Christ and the Church, can be traced to those warriors who came to the Holy Land after the First Crusade. Their founding, of course, was not a planned event. It was the completely spontaneous response of some Catholics to the problems facing them in the Holy Land. The pilgrims had to be protected. The sick and needy had to be cared for. And the safety of the captured holy places had to be assured. Over time, four main groups of warrior monks developed: the Hospitallers, the Templars, the Teutonic Knights, and the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre. Believing that fighting was a charitable activity, members of these orders said the office and rode out to kill their enemies. Some questioned whether these orders were in keeping with the dictates of the Gospel of Christ. If the Medican brothers preached the gospel, the military brothers defended it. Let's give a little description of each of the four orders of warrior monks. The first is very famous, the Hospitallers. It began as an independent religious order founded to take care of sick pilgrims in a hospital. They followed the rule of St. Augustine and were especially devoted to St. John the Baptist. Their real name was the Order of the Hospital of St. John of Jerusalem, reflecting this devotion to St. John. They really had a preferential option for the poor. They considered themselves serfs of the poor of Christ. The Grand Master of the Order was called the Guardian of the Poor, and the brothers were allowed to wear only humble clothing because, and I quote, "Our Lord's the poor go about naked and meanly dressed, and it would be wrong and improper for the serfs to be proud and the Lord humble." The Hospitallers cared for the sick in the most luxurious manner possible in their Jerusalem hospital. It was a world-class facility. It admitted patients regardless of illness, nationality, or sex. Not only did they admit Jews and Muslims, but they accommodated their dietary laws. The hospital in Jerusalem was a massive facility with a maximum capacity of 2,000 separate beds. And in overflow situations, the brothers' dormitory was used by the sick while the brothers slept on the floor. Patients were provided excellent food and care, including meat portions 3 times a week and white bread. All of this was in a quantity and quality foreign to all but the noblest members of medieval society. Four surgeons and physicians attended at the hospital and practiced Western medicine based on the techniques taught at the medical school in Salerno. Whenever the kingdom's army mobilized, the doctors went with them into the field. And they cared for all, Muslim or Christian. Then there's the Templars. They were originally known as the Poor Knights of Christ, and they became known as the Knights of the Temple, or the Templars. They lived by the Cistercian rule and took vows to live the evangelical counsels, those counsels I talked about, poverty, chastity, and obedience. And they added a vow to protect Christian pilgrims traveling from the port of Jaffa to Jerusalem. The nobility of Christendom eventually granted them large amounts of land, and they became known for their discipline in battle and strict obedience. For example, a Templar was not allowed even to adjust his stirrup without permission from his superior. Templars lived by 5 major rules, the 5 major rules of the order. 1, to fight to the death for the holy places of Christendom. 2, to refuse to be ransomed if captured. 3, to accept every combat regardless of the odds. 4, to refuse quarter or ransom to Muslim prisoners. And 5, to give their lives to defend any Christian attack by a Muslim. Despite the strictness and difficulty of the Templar life, many were drawn to it. St. Bernard helped recruitment through his general support and even wrote about it in a treatise called On the Praise of the New Knighthood. In this, he described the meritorious aspect of fighting for Christ with a potential for martyrdom. I can quote him. "Life is indeed fruitful and victory glorious. But according to holy law, death is better than either of those. For if those are blessed who die in the Lord, how much more blessed are those who die for the Lord?" You can begin to get a picture of the mindset of the great crusaders. The Templars grew in membership, prominence, and influence in the Holy Land and also in Europe. They eventually had 600 knights, which combined with the Hospitallers amounted to half the total available knights in the Latin East. Their power in Christendom was rooted in 9,000 feudal lordships and manors they owned. They provided a large base of resources and financial influence. Templar houses became known as important financial centers in Europe and served as places of deposit for crusaders traveling to the Holy Land. This in turn inaugurated the first primitive system of ATMs, since those who deposited fund in a Templar house in Europe could withdraw that amount minus a fee at Templar houses in the Latin East. As the number of transactions grew, so did the Templar coffers. Their financial holdings and power became the envy of royalty and nobility throughout Europe, but especially in France. This situation excited the jealousy of the despotic Philip IV, the Fair of France, who arrested the master of the order and other knights on false charges. He managed to confiscate a great deal of their money. Despite this inauspicious ending, during their existence, the Templars faithfully served Christendom, especially through the witness of 20,000 brothers who gave their lives for their fellow Christians. Then the third group is the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre. Godfrey de Bouillon, the hero of the First Crusade, founded the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre in 1099 as the military guard for the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The order contained knights living a secular life and also living as canons of the church, embracing the evangelical councils. Their religious order had canons of the church embracing the evangelical councils, but it also contained knights living a secular life who vowed to defend the tomb of Christ. Operating very closely with the kings of Jerusalem, they made the order a powerful institution, but it steadily became a ceremonial and service organization. The Knights of the Holy Sepulchre continue today to serve the church through their spiritual devotion to the Holy City and their assistance to Christians in the Holy Land. And finally, the Teutonic Knights. This is an interesting story. They originated through the action of German merchants in 1190 at the Siege of Acre. They began by simply establishing a hospital in the Crusader camp to care for the sick, wounded, and dying combatants. But within a decade, their focus shifted to military matters. Like the other military religious orders, they bound themselves in service to Christ and the church. They embraced a personal identification with the Savior. Their motto was, "Who fights us, fights Jesus Christ." The order was devastated by being decisively defeated by Polish forces in the Battle of Tannenberg in the early 1400s. Their numbers dwindled through the centuries, but they continued to exist as a small order of nobility centered in Austria. They had a very limited number by World War II, but they suffered even greater loss when 12 of their knights were hanged by the Nazis for their role in the assassination plot against Adolf Hitler. So these military religious orders were a unique spiritual innovation in the life of the church. While the Crusades gave the medieval warriors of Christendom a temporary outlet for spiritual benefit through the use of their martial skill, the military orders provided also a permanent place for the knight in a monastic life. The warrior, a strong man taking pride in his strength, was asked to use the strength in his sword in the service of the weak, to step out of his own world and become a monk, and yet keep his sword by his side and his lance in his hand. The Crusades have always been controversial, but since the Reformation, their memory has suffered from the creation of a false narrative and myth history designed to attack the Catholic Church generally and the papacy specifically. Despite the significant work of Crusade historians and scholars over the last generation,
the authentic story of the Crusaders remains locked within academia. The truth is there, and we all need to know it. The record needs to be set straight. And that is our effort here on BreadboxMedia.com. I'm Chuck Coughlin. Thank you.